session number 9253, reel 30.
Mr. Jack Dorgan, reel 30. You were telling me about how you get home a little early every alternate Saturday. Would you still do your scouting activities during 1917?
Oh, yes, very much so. We, our scout troop, been living in Ashenden, only 2.5 miles or so from the coast. Naturally, we camped down on the coast among the sand hills. Most weekends we had weekend camping, and then we got further afield often. There was some personal friends of mine who had a traction engine business at State Ford, which is quite near Ashenden, and they repaired the old type traction engine, they called them. That was the only means of transport in those days, which was the preliminary to the buses of today. And Bob Gordon, I had a traction truck, big lumber sled, only about 3 miles an hour it would travel. And he used to take our camping equipment and our scouts in the traction and truck, and we would go out to the River Wansbeck, away along towards Hexham and the areas around that way. So we got camping in a bigger way. At the same time, scouting in Northumberland was growing.
Even during the war?
Even during the war, yes.
Did it take on a more military angle with the war being on? Was there any drill or anything?
No. You know, for your question, no. You know, really speaking, my experiences in the war, we never considered ourselves regular soldiers. We always, at the back of our mind, we were territorial soldiers. And the territorial army raised in defense of your own country. Always at the back of our minds, we in the territorial army. We were very proud of the fact that we were in the territorial army and not the regular army. And we used to do our training in the army with that viewpoint always before us, so that it was never more in front of us in my scouting. My scouting life was altogether different, absolutely different to my army territorial life.
Did you ever get any holidays or time off from the mines?
The only time you did, it was your own expense. There was no such thing as the Ashenden colliery closing down for a week or a fortnight in those years. And in fact, as I think back, scouts in my scout troop in Ashenden were very much privileged in the fact that the boys in the scout troop and in the other scout troops also of Ashenden, they got a week's holiday in the summer in which other boys never had. There was no organized holidays. Nobody ever. If anybody did in Ashenden go for a week's holiday, it wasn't the ordinary miner or the miner's family. The worst people one could hear, and they were always proud to talk about it, who the deputies, for instance, who had a regular salary, regular wage, who could afford to go away by train to another part of England and have a week's holiday. Nobody ever thought of going abroad in those years, but lots of fellows, even fellows working at the colliery, for instance, fellows working in the offices, they had a regular wage every week. So they knew what their income was and they could provide for having a week's holiday. But the ordinary miner, he was relying on being in work every week, and that didn't happen. For instance, in the winters of Ashington Colliery, for instance, in the winters, we were very much subjected to the fact that the coal didn't get away from Blyth Harbour to take the coal down to London, where all the Ashington coal was sold, which meant, of course, that there was short time, many, many times in the winter, and each of the pits had their own butter time.
You mentioned that. This was still going on in 1917, though.
Oh, yes, yes.
Overall, though, was your pay adequate that you got as a putter in 1917?
Well, I can only speak for myself. And I was a big lad, strong, and when I was putting, I made good money. What we call good money was, I was at the top of the list always among putter lads in regard to their pay. Many of the lads who weren't as big as me and as strong as me naturally had far less money than myself at the end of the week to draw. But in all those years when I was putting, I did very well for myself. Being at home as well helped a lot.
Were you and your mother still buying this house that you mentioned earlier?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, mother did that, yes. I had to, in 1917, of course, I came home and that house was there. But I didn't need the house because we had no intention of getting married till the end of the war. My girlfriend, who had been sweethearting with me since before the war, do I talk about the war now, about our marriage now? That's 1918.
So you were still living at home at this time?
That's right.
By this time, you mentioned earlier, very early on in the interview, that once you started working, that the family poverty had largely gone and the family was much better off.
Oh, yes.
So you were living fairly comfortably at this time, were you?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Because, you see, in 1917, my father, who didn't have very good health, as he had stone dust on the lungs and he often had days off. But it was three lads in the family, myself on Class W in 1917, and then there was brother Tom, who had been put in and then joined up into the Naval Division, and then Nickel, the younger. There was three lads all working. So that our family were fairly, not well off, but comfortably off as regards finances and so on.
Was there any shortages of food at this point in the war?
No, there was always plenty of food to be got, as far as I know, yes.
Right. Getting back to the actual mine working, you've mentioned that the deputy, for instance, had to visit every part of his workings every 5 hours. Mm. Were there any other rules or regulations or safety regulations that you can remember that you had to that were enforced?
Well, of course, I was the deputy in later life, but not in 1917. In 1917, I was only a putter lad.
But what rules and regulations, safety regulations, would apply to you as a putter? What couldn't you do?
Couldn't do. Did anything I wanted. I always felt myself privileged, because all the deputies, wherever I came to, all the different quarters, when I went in, you change every quarter, you know, quarter of the year, what they call the quarter, you change it into a different part. Sometimes, I remember one quarter that I was in a district which was very, very wet, and lots of water always to be encountered. I had an awful time on. We couldn't make very good money in that time, but we always managed very well, yes.
But were there any rules, like, for instance, you're not now allowed to take cigarettes or smoking materials down the mine?
Oh,
no. Was that not allowed?
Well, I never smoked. So, I mean, the question of smoking never crossed my mind, you know. I never smoked cigarettes. In fact, I've never smoked cigarettes in the whole of my life. And it's only in the latter years of my life, well, since I retired, really, that I started to smoke cigars, small cigars, and I allow myself one a day now.
So there weren't any regulations like that that affected you?
Oh, you were searched, you know. You weren't allowed to strike a match down the pit, you know. And, mind you, the deputy... Or was it? No. When you got down to the bottom of the shaft, the official there went through in a, I don't know, not really satisfactory way. He would say, "Are you all right? You're not carrying nothing," meaning matches or cigarettes. You weren't allowed to take them down the pit, nor a pipe, of course. He had no smoking materials. He said, "Any smoking materials?" Well, he never bothered me, because he knew I never smoked.
Were there any other rules like that that you can think of?
Well, you were never allowed to have you never had a quarrel. A quarrel which stopped at once. And the nearest of a quarrel, you never had quarrel with an official. Official always was very careful not to have a quarrel with any of his work people. You might have words, what I mean by a discussion, argument, and arguments could get very high if a man thought that he was not getting plenty. I remember one time when I was putting, and I found that I wasn't being paid the fourpences on my score. So that I went to the cabin where the official was in, and I spoke to the overman there, and I complained heatedly about this complaint of mine. And I remember I was a young fella sitting in the cabin. I might mention a cabin down the pit. They called them cabins. At the bottom of the shaft would be an opening with a door on, and it was an office, laid out as an office. Now, there was an inner office and an outer office when you went in, and the division between the inner office and the outer office was timber about 2'6" high. That was to separate any violent young fellas like myself from getting into where the official sat at a table inside. And I'm leaning over this this dividing wall made of timber, and a young fella sitting in with the old man interrupted and asked me what was agitating me. And I says, "You'll go to hell. I'm discussing this with Tom Pollard, the old woman." And Tom Pollard says, "Jack, this is your manager." "Oh," I says, "I'm sorry, but never mind." It was a young fellow who had just started to be a manager at the colliery that week or so on. But he wanted an explanation, and I explained what my trouble was. And he says, "I think he's in the right," to the overman. The overman says, "All right, Jack, we'll put it right." Yes.
Now, I know you weren't a coal hewer at this time, and that you became one in 1919, but they were the men working in front of you as a putter. Could you tell me what they would be doing in 1917, what their job was?
Well, of course, they were the old-type miner, and it was old-type mining, with driving roadways. They would drive a roadway a matter of about 40, 50 or 80 yards along, and then, and they would simultaneously at either side would other workmen, coal hewers, moving forward. And these roadways were a matter of about 8 foot wide and about 6 foot high. Now, then the coal seam, as I said before, at Ashenden, would be anyway about 3 foot six high, which meant the coal hewer would work in getting the coal out this 8 foot wide roadway and leaving above him the coal, stone seam above. So he could only work as far as his pick would allow him. And if you can imagine a roadway 8 foot wide and about 6 foot high, and the bottom part of that roadway, 3 foot of it was coal, and then the other would be stone. Now then, with the pick, his shaft, he would be lying on the floor with a wooden cracket. The wooden cracket was two pieces of wood nailed together so that sort of a small stool, and he would put that under his shoulder, and then the rest of his body would be lying flat on the ground. And with his pick, he would undercut with his pick to a depth as far as the pick with its shaft on would allow him to go forward. And then when he had gone as far forward as he could, which might be a matter of about 3 foot six in depth in the coal and on the bottom of the coal seam, he would start on the right-hand side, if he was an ordinary right-handed man, and he would do the same up the side of the coal seam, which I said before was 3 foot six in height, and he would do the same there, so that after he had gone 3 foot six on the floor of the coal seam and on the right-hand side of the coal seam, 3 foot six, then he would stop what they call hewing, and he had a set of gear, a stand, metal stand, which he'd put up to the roof and the floor, and with a long drill with a sharpened edge, he would turn by the handle this drill into the solid side of the coal seam, and he would go in the 3'6" that he had gone under to cut and side cut, and then he would proceed to load that hole made by the drill which he had drilled. First of all, he would clean the hole out with a scraper, and then after he had cleaned it out, he would put the required amount of powder, gelatine it was, he would put the required amount of gunpowder gelatine into the hole and push it in with the plunger to the far end of his 3'6" drill hole. But before he placed the last in, he always had a long cable wire with a detonator on the end. The detonator was about the length of your little finger, about half the thickness of your little finger, and highly explosive. And you had to be very careful with these, so that you plunged it, you put them in, and then you got plugs of clay, and you cleared the whole of the hole up until it was sealed up, and then you would bring that wire, let the wire hang out until the deputy came. The deputy would come along, and the deputy had the equipment to ignite the gelatine through the detonator, and there was a required distance of 30 yards that the deputy had to stretch his wire, and then he gently got behind a tub, and after making sure that nobody in the vicinity was there, that everybody was drawn back, he would shout the warning, fire. And then with his plunger, he had a plunger to detonate the powder and so on. And if everybody had done the job properly, the coal would be lying loose. It was only had to wait until the fumes of the detonator and the fumes from the powder to clear out, which took a little while because, you know, for air in a coal mine to travel, you must have an intake and an outtake. Well, you didn't have such a thing as an intake and an outtake in that short distance. You later joined up with a man, perhaps was working same kind of work alongside you, about 50 or 60 yards away to the right on and to the left, and the air could circulate around that way. But generally, you had to wait quite a while, 10 minutes, quarter of an hour, for the fumes to go. And then the coal had to be filled into the tubs.
And that's
hard work, that was. Very hard work.
And that's what you were doing in 1919?
That's right. I didn't like it.
Now, so besides this job, they also had to lay the rails, the coal hewers.
Yes.
And would they be responsible for putting up the pit props?
The coal hewer is responsible for his own safety as regards, if the roof is a good roof, well, he didn't need to put a pair of gears, put the whole pair of gears up. That is, two pit props at each side of the roadway, and then a roof plank held up by the two side props. Well, it depended on your roof. If it was a good roof, you didn't need to put it for 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 feet. But if it was a bad roof, naturally you had to put them much closer. He was responsible for that himself. And the deputy, when he came around to visit every 5 hours, he would inspect the condition of the roof, and perhaps he would advise the man to put another pair of gears, what we call a pair of gears, two props and a plank for roof, as extra support. But the man, the coolio, was responsible for his own safety with regards to that, yes.
Now, you mentioned earlier there were bad areas. You mentioned one bad area was where there was water. How would that affect working?
Did I ever tell you the story of the two men that was where the water was creeping up on them?
Not on this tape, no. Do you want to tell us?
Well, yes. Well, I remember on one occasion when we had two men working, and the roadway leading down to the working place was on a slope, just a gentle slope, but it was making water. And the water, of course, ran down the gentle slope into the working place where the two men were working. And the fitters had, under the deputy's instructions, had laid an iron pipe to carry the water away. At the end of the pipe, there would be a guard to stop any stones getting into the iron pipe and just water being pulled in. And there was a pump stationed further back from the working place, which was drawn the water through the pipe back to where it be discharged safely. Alongside of it was another cable which had a pump attached to it, and it was pumping the air into the working place because there was no return. The pump pumped air in, and the action of the pump pumping air through the cable maintained a steady pull on the fresh air coming down the roadway, and then the bad air being pulled out by the pump. Now, what happened was that about 50 or 60 yards back from where the men were working, there was a fall in the roof. And it stretched for about 5 or 6 yards. The men were in no danger because the two pipes, one metal and one strong I don't know what you would call it. However, they were working and the air was going in, and it was being delayed in